Scott Dawson and Dash Wilder have a hell of a match with who's again, Johnny Gargano and Tomasino Ciampa.
Say my name.
Tomasino Ciampa.
You're goddamn right.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Can you believe that we're in September already? Summer's over. Unofficially. Officially, we still are in the middle of summer, but unofficially, Labor Day weekend marks the end of the summer, which is kind of depressing. But the one thing that's not depressing about it is that we get a day off on Monday. At least most of you do. I hope you do. This is episode 459 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for this Labor Day weekend. Sunday, September 4, 2016. I am the Solid Monster. And we lead off here with a thank you to everybody who listens to this podcast every single week, who supports this show every single week. And a thank you to Rolling Stone, who featured the Sound Off as part of its... it had a feature this week on the 18 wrestling podcasts that you must be listening to, that you need to listen to. And I don't think it was a ranked list, but the Sound Off was right smack dab in the middle of that list. It's up on rollingstone.com. It was the sports editor, too, who was the one who authored the feature. I knew the name from somewhere because I know I've pitched some people, like in my job. I work in PR, and I know I've pitched people before at Rolling Stone. Not this person, but his name looked familiar to me. And sure enough, it turns out he's one of the sports editors there, which is kind of cool. So to see the podcast included on Rolling Stone was just, it was a really cool thing. And I want to thank all of you for helping to make that happen here as we approach the 9-year anniversary of the show. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit here, too. Something else that's kind of fun that I want to share with everyone. But I want to also give a shout-out to Don Tony and Kevin Castle. They were also featured on that list, conspicuous by their absence, Wrestling Soup. Not quite sure how they got neglected, but you ought to give them a listen as well. They deserve to be on there. A lot of good shows on there. A lot of wrestler shows, fan-made shows. Somebody said this to me, and I don't know if it's true, that the Sound Off was the only solo-hosted podcast on the list. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but if it is, that's even more cool. It's not easy, I can tell you that. It's not easy to talk to yourself and do a one-man show every week for 2 hours. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that. You could check it out. I put the link up on Twitter and Facebook. You could see the list of all the shows on there. It was a very nice write-up about me and my show, so I just wanted to say thank you to them. And this has been a great year. This has probably been our best year yet. When I really look back on the growth of the show, stuff like that, you know, I mean, being featured on the Rolling Stone website, all the interviews I've done, the people I've had a chance to talk to, it's been our best year yet. So I say onward and upward. Audible continues to support this podcast, as it has for the last few years. It is still offering listeners of this Sound Off a trial of its Audible audiobook service. If you sign up using our link, which is audibletrial.com/solomonster, you can sample their service for 30 days. You can check it out, see if it's something that you like. They've got tens and tens and tens of thousands of audiobooks for you to pick. And if you sign up, here's the cool thing about it. If you sign up with our link, you get one free audiobook that you get to choose. You don't have to pay for it. And if you should cancel your trial for any reason, and I say you shouldn't, but if you do, in those 30 days, you don't get billed, you get to keep your audiobook. It's pretty cool. You don't really find too many offers like that, which is why I wanted to partner with Audible and use them as a sponsor for the show, because I thought that what they were offering was actually pretty cool. And there's a lot of wrestling books up there. You know, Bob Holly, I've interviewed him and Bill Apter most recently. And Bill, you know, he narrates his own audiobook, which is kind of cool. Some people do, some people don't, but you can go on there right now and check it out. If you do, please use our link, audibletrial.com/solemnmonster. It doesn't really count unless you go through the sign-up process. It's all kind of for nothing. You got to punch the link in and then sign up, and when you do, you're supporting the podcast and getting yourself a free book. So check that out. Also, I wanted to mention our store on Pro Wrestling Tees is still going strong. ProWrestlingTees.com/SolemnmonsterSoundsOff. I love getting the photos that you guys tweet me wearing the shirts. I just had one of our listeners, Alan, tweet me a photo of him doing the Finn freeze, which I guess is Finn Balor is always doing this thing in his photos on his social media called the Finn freeze. So he was doing that while wearing one of our shirts. Anything wacky like that, just tweet them to me, and I'll give you a retweet. And if you want to become a PayPal VIP, another way to support the show, you can do so by going on the solemnmonster.com, and you'll see the PayPal donate button on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a shout-out and a wrestling nickname here on this podcast. I want to give a thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez, of course. Deadpool James Herrera, another one of our loyal listeners for many years. Beast Mode Brock Joseph. Misfit Miguel Mendoza. Alvin Chainsaw Siegerts. Dashing David Vera. Payback Tejas Bagwat. Nemesis Nathan Moyers. The Flying Guillotine Grady Clements. Isaac the Metaphor Fox. And finally here, one of our listeners has a brand new podcast called Dre's Raw Review. You can check it out at dresrawreview.podbean.com or on iTunes. So thank you to those of our VIPs who made a donation this week. Again, you can do so at any time on thesolemnmonster.com. I already did this on TV Tracks. I want to do it here, too. When I was talking about the Bret Hart-Seth Rollins stuff from the podcast last week, and I was talking about why I don't think the buckle bomb should be banned, and I went through a whole thing about, you know, you ban one move, what's to stop you from banning a whole bunch of moves, and how they banned the pile driver many years ago, and I could only think of one instance where somebody was hurt in WWE on a pile driver, and somehow I mentioned one that kind of an obscure example that a lot of people may not even know about, with Undertaker allegedly hurting Triple H on a tombstone, and then, of course, we didn't see Undertaker do another tombstone for almost a year after that. He was doing the Last Ride powerbomb. There's a reason for that. And I neglected the most infamous, perhaps career-altering powerbomb of all time, which is Owen Hart dropping Steve Austin on his neck. And that was a tombstone, although it wasn't a traditional tombstone. Owen fell on his ass instead of falling on his knees like he was supposed to. But I was thinking more in terms of the traditional power bomb, maybe the tombstone. I don't know what I was thinking. I clearly wasn't thinking straight at the time. So I was able to get an amended clip with an apology up on TV Tracks. And I mean, I know it's not a big deal, but stuff like that bothers the hell out of me. I don't know how that slipped my mind. So yes, of course I'm aware. Some people said, well, didn't you remember? Of course I remember. Just not on that day. But I was upset because I talked about that for like a good 20 minutes. And I thought I was trying to make a lot of very, what I thought were valid points. And I knew the moment I realized that I had missed that pile driver, I just got so pissed off because I knew exactly what was going to happen. Because everything I said was just going to go up into the ether and get lost. And it was just going to be about the pile driver that I forgot. And that really pissed me off. So I want to thank Trax for letting me get the little apology up before the clip up on his channel, and I just wanted to apologize again here because I should have remembered that, and I didn't, and I don't know why. I am going to be starting a new weekly countdown this week on the show. This is what I was mentioning before when I said I had some cool news to share about our anniversary coming up. We're starting a new countdown. It's been a while since we've done one of these. This is a countdown of my nine favorite, and in my opinion, best WWE interviews or promos, call them what you want, of all time. I have ranked what I feel are the nine greatest promos ever for a variety of reasons. There really is no specific criteria here. It could be a live in-ring promo. It could be a taped sit-down interview. It could be that, you know, the segment just entertained the hell out of me, made me laugh, It could be that they elicited some kind of emotion from me. It could be some historical significance that the promo has. And I'm limiting it to WWE only for one reason. It's not that I'm just like a WWE snob or anything like that. It's because when I made my initial list, so I jotted a list down when I realized, okay, this is the countdown that I want to do. And I had my initial list down, and I couldn't keep the number to 9. Do you know how hard it is to make a list of the best promos and keep it only to 9? I didn't realize how difficult it was going to be. So, unfortunately, you know, Dusty Rhodes' Hard Time promo, Mick Foley's Kane Dewey promo, both of which would have definitely made my list. They are ineligible because, just simply put, I couldn't fit them all. I had to limit it to WWE only. Otherwise, I had a whole bunch. I had some ECW, I had some NWA, and you know, WCW. I just couldn't do it. But those two, I can tell you would have been at the top of my list. Dusty Rhodes probably would have been number one. I'll just say it now. So they definitely would have been on my list. Those are two of the best promos in the history of wrestling. If you have never seen them, you should go on YouTube right now and check them out. Hard Times and Kane Dewey. So what I'll do is I'm going to reveal them in order at the end of the podcast for each of the next 9 weeks. Now you might be asking, why 9? Why 9 weeks? Well, because 9 weeks from today is November 6th. And that happens to be the 9-year anniversary episode of this podcast. So we are counting down to our 9-year anniversary show. That's why we're doing it this way. That's why we're starting it this week. That's why it's 9. That's the gimmick. That's why we're doing it that way. But I think 9 years, and it's like, man, I've been doing this for a long time. And many of you have been along with me for the ride since day one. Some of you only started listening this year. After the Rolling Stone mention, this may be the very first time that some people are listening to this show. I appreciate the hell out of all of you, no matter how long you've been listening for. And why promos? You know, because so much emphasis is placed on promo ability, right? And it is very important. It's very important that you be able to speak and get yourself over that way and communicate with, you know, the audience. And all of that is very important. And I think it also kind of highlights how most of them today, I don't want to say all of them, like there are some really kick-ass promos on TV today, but a lot of them today, they're so overly scripted. You know, you got poor Titus O'Neil tripping over every other word 2 weeks ago while clearly trying to remember all the words that they wanted him to memorize. It's terrible. It's just awful. I would bet you, I don't know this for sure, but I would bet you that none of the promos on my list were memorized word for word. Even if somebody did put something down on a piece of paper for them, or they said, hey, this is what we want you to get across, that's fine, okay? But these people went out there and they made it their own. And that's a big part of why these are 9 of the best promos of all time. So I will reveal number 9. We'll do that after the mailbag at the end of the show today. We'll start the list with number 9 and we'll work our way up to number 1. First thing I want to do here is talk about the death at the age of 82 of WWE Hall of Famer Harry Fujiwara, better known as the Devious One, Mr. Fuji. He did wrestle for many years before becoming a manager. WWE had a very nice promo package, a tribute video for him on Raw this past Monday night. He was a mainstay for many years in that company. 5 tag team titles he won in WWE with 2 different tag team partners. That being Professor Toru Tanaka and Masa Saito, the same Masa Saito who went to prison with Ken Patera after the infamous McDonald's incident, which I've talked about here before. Fuji and Tanaka, they were a pretty big team back in the 70s. Kind of, you know, predated me, but I've seen their work. I've seen their matches. I know they feuded with some of the top guys in the company at the time, you know, Bruno Sammartino, Pedro Morales. Fuji left WWE a few times before eventually transitioning into the role of manager, which is what I knew him for growing up as a fan in the 80s, Mr. Fuji or Master Fuji. It was him, Bobby Heenan, Captain Lou, Jimmy Hart, the Slickster, right? I mean, that was the golden age to me growing up as a WWE fan. That was the golden age of managers in wrestling, and that's not even mentioning guys like Jim Cornette and J.J. Dillon and Paulie Dangerously and all the other managers in the NWA and AWA and the other promotions in the 80s. I mean, there's a reason people call it the Golden Era. That's one of many reasons why people call it that. Fuji's big thing was always throwing salt in people's eyes. That's how Bret Hart lost his first WWF title at WrestleMania. Fuji, you know, blasted him in the face with a fistful of salt. One of my most memorable Fuji moments was the double turn that they did at the Survivor Series in 88. Fuji had been managing Demolition. Demolition was a heel team for a while, but people were into them. I mean, people kind of organically started to get behind Demolition on their own. So he was managing them at the time, but he turned on them. And he turned on them in the middle of one of the elimination matches at the Survivor Series. And Warlord and Barbarian, they had been babyfaces as the Powers of Pain. They helped Fuji up after Demolition, took him out. He was down on the ground. People were cheering. Powers of Pain, they saw this guy in the ground and said, hey, we got to give him a helping hand. And they helped him up. And all of a sudden, you know, he took them on and they became, or he became their manager. And the Powers of Pain, basically, it was a double turn. They flipped both teams. Two teams flipped on that show. Demolition officially became babyfaces. And Powers of Pain went heel. And then they did a handicap match between the teams at WrestleMania 5. And I remember them airing a skit showing Fuji running a 5K. Like the day before. It was either the day of or the day before WrestleMania. And he's in his full suit. The full suit and hat. And he's running in a 5K race to get ready for their match. That is not suggested attire, by the way, for a 5K. So I remember that. I thought that was funny. Obviously, his biggest success, or what he'll most be remembered for, unless you are an older fan, maybe you have other memories of Fuji. I guess, you know, Fuji Vice and stuff like that, you might remember him for more. But I think for a lot of people, he'll be remembered as the manager of Yokozuna. He managed him to, which is kind of funny to me because neither one of them are Japanese. But, you know, he managed Yokozuna to two world titles. It kept Fuji in the spotlight a lot longer than he would have been. He would have been gone long before that had Yokozuna not taken off. Of course, I mentioned Fuji Vice. Who the hell can forget Fuji Vice? I didn't even remember Fuji Vice when I was a kid. I didn't first see that until, I'd say it's probably in the last decade or so, I saw Fuji Vice for the first time in Fuji General. I think there was another one in there. Him and Don Morocco. That is the definition of so bad it's good. I mean, the acting, words can't even describe how awful the acting is, but that's part of the charm. And you watch some of them, and Don Morocco, he is barely keeping it together. It was so bad, but yet so freaking entertaining to watch. I know they have a Mr. Fuji collection up on the network right now. I haven't checked the, I know they have a bunch of matches. I didn't see Fuji Vice and those things listed. They have to be in there. I mean, how do you put a Mr. Fuji collection of clips up on the network and not have that in there? I would imagine it's there. If it is, go check it out if you've never seen it before. It is very, very funny. Fuji had a rep in wrestling as one of the most well-known pranksters or ribbers, I guess they would say. And, you know, a lot of the names that you hear when it comes to stories about ribs that were played on people, you hear about Dynamite Kid, who was actually you hear those stories and he just comes across as a ruthless asshole. But Dynamite Kid, Owen Hart, Kurt Hennig. But Fuji is probably honestly at the top of that list. And, when I interviewed JTG on the show a few months ago, he brought up the infamous story that's been told for years of Fuji cooking up someone's dog and feeding it to them, which Al Snow has said was the inspiration for the pepper angle that him and the Big Boss Man did back in 99. That's where it comes from. Now, there's been different versions of this story told over the years. I know Fuji did a shoot interview many years ago with RF Video, and he confirmed the dog story. So I'm sure it probably happened in some form or fashion. Whose dog it was and what the circumstances were, the story changes. He claims that he invited a bunch of wrestlers over for a barbecue or something, and he marinated and grilled the dog teriyaki style. And they didn't know it was a dog that they were eating. And when Don Morocco revealed to them that it was a dog, they started puking. That is beyond fucked up. I got a kick out of the Al Snow Boss Man storyline back when they did it, but that was just a stupid storyline on TV. That is messed up. If that actually happened, and it sounds like it did, I'm sorry. That's fucked up. I know Fuji was working for, I think it was Regal Theaters, as a movie usher for many years. WWE put him in the Hall of Fame back in 07. I don't know what he was doing more recently. WWE didn't give a cause of death. It may have been natural causes. I don't know if he was sick. Fuji was entertaining. He's one of those guys I will always remember from my childhood. He was very entertaining. As a matter of fact, I still have in my box, wherever it is, whatever old, the giant rubber LJN figures from the 80s, I still have them. Some of them got thrown away. I'm still pissed off about that. But I have a whole bunch of them. And I know I had Fuji with the hat and all. And actually, if I remember, I think Fuji's LJN came with a cane. A little cane that kind of slipped through his hand. I hope I still have it. I don't know. Honestly, I don't know if it's still part of my collection or not. But I did have that at some point. I'm sure they're not worth anything. They're all the figures I had are beaten to shit, pretty much. But Fuji was an entertaining guy. I would not put him in my top five list of greatest managers or anything like that. Probably not even my top 10. But I'm bummed anytime I hear something like this, because it's just another piece of what I remember from my childhood. Sorry to hear that. We also lost Gene Wilder this week. I know that's not wrestling related, but this was an even bigger death. One of the great actors of this or any generation. Apparently complications from Alzheimer's disease, which is just terrible. I was watching an interview after I heard he died. When you hear somebody died, you go on YouTube, you start looking up their clips and stuff. And I was looking to see what his most recent interview was, because he didn't do a lot of interviews, I don't think. He didn't do, talk shows and stuff. The last, most recent stuff that I found was, an appearance on Conan O'Brien from, 13 years ago, when his book first came out. And he did, a Larry King interview, but he didn't really do a whole lot of stuff. The most recent, and maybe the last interview he did that I found, was a sit-down he did for about half an hour at the 92nd Street Y here in New York. And you could tell even then, yes, he was getting older, but you could kind of tell there was something going on there. He might have already been sick. It was kind of a shame to see that. Everyone talks about Willy Wonka. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. I don't ever remember seeing Willy Wonka. I might have when I was very, very young. If I did, apparently it didn't leave a big impression on me, so I'm thinking I never saw it. And I may be the only one who never saw it. But I'm more of a Blazing Saddles guy. Silver Streak, maybe my favorite movie of his that I ever saw him in. Stir Crazy, See No Evil, Hear No Evil. Pretty much anything with him and Richard Pryor together is just comedy gold. I saw Mel Brooks was on Jimmy Fallon this past week. He was telling some Gene Wilder story. So very, very sad to hear not only that he died. People get old, they pass away, but whenever I hear stuff like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, cancer, it pisses me off. It just makes me angry. So very, very sad to hear that. If you were hoping to see Randy Orton get murdered by Brock Lesnar for a second time, unless you live in Chicago, you are out of luck. Orton Lesnar 2 has been booked for the Raw live event in Chicago, September 24th. That's the night before the very first Raw brand pay-per-view. And that begs the question, why would you book that match on a house show the night before a pay-per-view? Apparently they needed an attraction to help fill the house that night. They asked Brock to do the show, and he said, okay. Simple as that. He even got to pick his opponent. So, poor Randy. Imagine being the person to call up Randy Orton and give him the good news. While he still has those 10 staples in his head from SummerSlam, which I'm sure made his new wife very, very happy. Would have been hilarious if Brock would have said, I want Jericho. Right? If he gets to pick his opponent, right? Jericho's on the Raw brand. He could have easily said, I want Chris Jericho. I seriously think I would have considered buying a ticket and flying myself to Chicago for that show had that happened. But Orton Lesnar too, I'm not flying myself anywhere for that. Ryback has a new podcast, because why not? It's called Conversation with the Big Guy. It's him and Pat Buck as his co-host. They've been friends for many years. And he had some interesting things to say about WWE on the show. You could find the write-ups, or you could listen to the show itself. You can give it a listen if you want to, if you want to hear everything that he had to say. But one of the more interesting things, first of all, he claims that he walked away, the contract he walked away from WWE, was worth $1.5 million over the next 3 years. And there were some people I see, like, you know, even on our Facebook page, oh, that's nonsense. I don't believe for a second that WWE offered Ryback $1.5 million. You know what? $1.5 million over 3 years? Yes, I could see WWE offering him a contract like that. If they wanted to keep him, it's over a three-year period. I don't see what's so unrealistic about that. To be honest with you, there was nothing in this interview that I heard. And again, when you hear guys that maybe come off as disgruntled or bitter and they leave the company, yes, you have to listen to everything they say with a grain of salt. It's coming from their own perspective and their own bias about things. And maybe Ryback thought he was better than he actually was. And maybe on the flip side, maybe he was actually better than they treated him. And they could have done more with him. I do think that there was a real opportunity for him to kind of make it to that next level. And the timing was just very, very shitty for him in 2012. You know, John Cena had gotten hurt. And they kind of slipped Ryback into his spot for that Hell in a Cell match against Punk. Ryback was hot at the time. He was unbeaten. And that pay-per-view actually did pretty well. People were kind of getting into him. And then he lost. And it's not just that he lost. I think it's the way that he lost. It was like a low blow. And Brad Maddox with a fast count. It was all just nonsense. And then he went on like a pay-per-view losing streak. Month after month, he lost every match he was in. And so at that point, I think Ryback was pretty much done for. But I heard a lot of what he said here, and I didn't think to myself, oh man, this guy's full of shit. Like, everything he said sounded sensible and reasonable enough that, you know what, yes, this could have happened. Yes, I could see or hear in my head Vince McMahon making these promises to him, and this is what he was told, even though you hear some of this stuff and you think, man, there was never any chance that that would happen. The biggest thing he mentioned was that, you know, he's very upset, and he had conversations with Vince McMahon about what his plans were for him, and they wanted him to re-sign. You know, his contract was coming due. They wanted him to sign a new deal. When they put the Intercontinental title on him last year, it puzzled Ryback. He couldn't understand, why are they putting the Intercontinental title on me? And then all of a sudden, they were like, hey, we want you to sign a new contract, and it became very apparent to him, oh, okay, I see what's going on here. But the biggest kind of reveal or revelation, whatever you want to call it, on the show, I thought, was him mentioning a conversation he had with Vince McMahon, where Vince said, hey, look, WrestleMania this year in Dallas, we want to put you in a match against AJ Styles. And according to Ryback, in pitching the idea and pitching the match to him, Vince said that I want you to squash that little twerp. Now, I think people may have misunderstood, like maybe they read a transcript of what Ryback said. They thought that was Ryback referring to AJ as a little twerp. I went and I listened to the interview. I wanted to make sure I wasn't reading something out of context. So I actually listened to what he said. And what he said was that Vince McMahon pitched the idea to him of a match with AJ Styles. And Vince McMahon sold him on this idea that you're going to squash that little twerp. And there were people who said, oh, that's bullshit. That's bullshit. That didn't happen. Ryback's full of crap. I don't know. It sounds pretty sensible to me. You have to think that when AJ Styles first came into WWE, and I don't know when, like what month or day it would have been that Vince pitched this idea to him. It had to be at least a month or two in advance. AJ had first come into the company. I don't think Vince McMahon was sold on AJ Styles on day one. I think it took many months for Vince McMahon to come around on this guy and see him for, you know, the talent that he was. And now here we are, you know, he just beat John Cena clean at SummerSlam, and he's wrestling for the championship again at the first SmackDown pay-per-view. I think it's safe to say that, you know, Vince McMahon is an AJ Styles guy, because AJ Styles would not be in the position he's in if Vince McMahon wasn't sold on the guy. But I fully believe that at the beginning of the year, January, February, he would have said something like that to Ryback. Now, did he believe that? Was he just saying that? Was he just paying lip service to the guy? Maybe. You know, maybe he didn't actually believe that AJ was a little twerp, and maybe he knew that Ryback wasn't beating him. Maybe he was just selling him a bill of goods. It wouldn't be the first time that Vince McMahon did that with someone, right? Not the first time that Vince McMahon has made a promise to someone and went back on it. I don't see what's so unrealistic or unbelievable about it. I could totally see that. Yeah, he also told the story about the Flex magazine cover, and this was one of the things that really bothered Ryback and factored into his decision to leave. What bothered him was the fact that certain people in the company were afforded opportunities that others were not, especially when it came to opportunities like media opportunities outside the company. So people like Roman Reigns would be on magazine covers and John Cena would be on magazine covers, but Ryback claims that, you know, Flex magazine, which I guess is a, you know, I don't know if it's a bodybuilding magazine or just a muscle and fitness type magazine, but they came to him and they said, we want you on the cover. He claims they said, there's nobody else on the WWE roster who really fits who we want on our cover but you. And he wanted to do it, and he went to the company and said, hey, they want me on the cover. Can I do this? And they said, no. I guess at first the WWE excuse was, we already have too many other superstars this month appearing on other magazines, which of course makes no sense. Who gives a shit, right? But that's what he claims they told him. So he waited a few months. And a few months go by and Flex is still interested and he goes back to the company and says, okay, they still want me on their magazine. Can I be on the magazine cover? And they then turned around and said to him, you can't do it because we're trying to get Roman Reigns on the cover of certain magazines. And as he's telling this story, it reminds me of the interview that I just did like a month ago. It was maybe not even a month ago. The interview that I did with Bob Holly, which if you haven't listened to it, you got to listen to it. It's probably the favorite interview I've ever done. There's a lot of good stuff in there. And Bob was in the company for 15 years. Yeah, you know, he wasn't headlining WrestleMania, but so what? He was in the company for 15 years. He saw a lot of guys come and go, and I'm sure he heard a lot of stuff and had a lot of promises made to him, and he did, and he talks about that in the interview. And I immediately thought of him when I heard Ryback telling this story. And the part of the interview that I did with Bob regarding the whole independent contractor versus employer debate that I brought up, you know, the fact that the company exerts total control over outside opportunities like that for their talent, and yet they're considered independent contractors. The whole thing is a joke. I mean, forget the internal company stuff. The fact that you're an independent contractor and a major magazine or whatever, fitness magazine comes to you and says, hey, we want to put you on the cover. You have to go to WWE and ask for permission, and they say no, and you can't be on the cover of the magazine. But yet you're an independent contractor. That is a joke. But the problem is, so long as nobody under contract speaks up about stuff like that, nothing's ever going to change. It's like the whole, why don't wrestlers unionize? Well, there's a reason why wrestlers don't unionize, right? I've heard Jim Ross talk about this before. You know, the wrestlers can't decide on, you know, what they want for lunch. How do you expect them to ever unionize? You know what, though? There's a lot of truth to that. You know, there are a lot of guys in WWE making a lot of money who don't have the incentive to stand up and say, hey, this is not right. Right? They're collecting some pretty big paychecks every week. Why would they stand up? They're in a cushy position. If it's a bunch of mid-card guys standing up, probably not going to mean much. But if you got a guy like a Cena, an Orton, I was going to say Lesnar, but the idea of that is just comical. But without guys like that standing up, nothing's ever going to change. So, check it out. It was an interesting interview. It was an interesting podcast. He talks about some other stuff, about why, all the different reasons why he left the company, broken promises, stuff we've heard from a lot of other guys before. Holly, CM Punk, I mean, you can go up and down the list. I don't see what's so unbelievable about these stories. I take what he says here at face value. I believe 100% that this is what he was told. I mentioned CM Punk. It's finally happening. CM Punk will finally make his debut inside the Octagon at UFC 203 next Saturday in Cleveland. One person who may not be there for it is Colt Cabana. Cabana and Punk, of course, they've been friends for something like 25 years. Both of them are currently being sued by WWE's doctor, Dr. Amon, for defamation after the podcast that Punk and Cabana did together 2 years ago. Apparently, people are saying that the two are no longer following each other on Twitter. Oh, no. They're not following each other on Twitter. Anyway, on Twitter, Front Row Brian, who I believe has broken some MMA stories before, he has a lot of contacts in that industry, he claims that there is a rift between the two of them, and what caused it, supposedly, is that Colt Cabana attended a Raw show. I don't know when, if it was in the last few months, if this was a year ago, if this was a few weeks ago, I have no idea. But he was allegedly at a Raw, and he went backstage, and he was taking pictures with people there, and Punk went nuts because he felt that it hurt his defense, or it could hurt his defense in the lawsuit, and it caused a big rift between the two of them. I have no idea if the story is true or not, unless Cabana or Punk confirms it one way or the other. Who the fuck knows if they're friends or not? I mean, how do you really even figure that out? But, you know, Joey Numbers of Wrestling Soup reminded me of the story that Hornswoggle told in his U shoot a few months ago. Him and Punk used to be friends. They had each other's phone number. They had a mutual friend. And I guess Hornswoggle had the person's phone number, then he got a new phone, or he lost his phone, he had to get a new one, whatever the case was. So he texted Punk. He still had Punk's number, and he texted him, and he said, hey, look, can I get the phone number of this person? Because I got a new phone. I lost their number. And this was well after Punk had left WWE. And Punk got upset, according to Hornswoggle. He got very upset because he saw that as Hornswoggle using him to get someone else's phone number. Oh, you're using me. Like that's the only reason I was ever friends with you, was to get this person's phone number in the unlikely event that you ever lost their phone number. And this is even though, again, Hornswoggle had this person's phone number. It's not like it was some, woman, hey, can I get her number or something like that. Punk just flew off the handle and that was it. Their friendship came to an end. So I could totally believe that CM Punk would end a friendship over something petty like that. Punk doesn't strike me as being the friendliest person that you would ever meet. He kind of comes across as a dick, to be honest with you. I think it's pretty safe to say. But let's talk about this fight, okay? He's fighting Mickey Gall next weekend, who has a 2-0 professional mixed martial arts record. Only one fight in the UFC, a submission win in the first round. 45 seconds is all it took. In fact, all five of his fights, the pro fights and the amateur fights that he's had, are submission wins, except for his very first fight, which was a win by decision. So I'm going to go ahead and make a prediction for this fight right now. I predict that Mickey Gall will beat CM Punk in the first round of their fight by submission. Probably by rear naked choke. But submission in round number one is my prediction. And I'm not one of these people who wants to see CM Punk get destroyed. I'll be honest with you, I'm not really sure why somebody would want to see a guy get wrecked. Like, a lot of wrestling fans, they can't wait to see CM Punk get his ass handed to him. Man, I want to see this guy get wrecked. I don't know if it's just because, again, Punk comes across as a dick, and so they just want to see him get his ass kicked, or if there's... It's like, some people have, like, this personal vendetta against him. Like, he betrayed us, he betrayed the wrestling fans, and so I hope he loses his first fight. It's like, get the fuck over yourself. You know what I mean? Like, did he do something to wrong you personally? You know, it's like, there's a lot of people I'm not too fond of that have been involved in wrestling. I wouldn't necessarily say that if they got into MMA, I'd want to see them get killed in the cage, or I'd want to see them lose. I mean, to me, you know, he's been training his ass off for it. I know the reports have been, like, not good. He's gotten knocked out in training. Who the hell knows? But he's been working his ass off. You know what? I applaud him for trying. It takes balls, man. It takes balls at his age. He's not a young guy. It takes balls at his age. After all the injuries, he just got recovered. He just recovered from back surgery. They had to delay this fight because he needed back surgery. Okay, that tells you something right there about the physical abuse that this guy has taken over the course of his career. So between age and injuries, to climb inside a cage and get your face pounded in, if that's his dream, if that's what he wants to do, then you know what? More power to him. I will take no joy and no pleasure in seeing him lose. But I do think he's losing. And I think he's losing quickly. Raw this past Monday was live from Houston, Texas. I put the poll up on Twitter. Almost 3,000 votes. That's a lot of votes. 93% thumbs up. 7% thumbs down. They opened strong and they ended strong. And I think that's why you see 93% thumbs up there. I thought the show really dragged, just really dragged ass in between. But, you know, Jericho and Neville had a really good match. Sheamus and Cesaro had a good match. So between those matches and the main event and everything that happened there, there you go. I mean, there are your three things that, that meet the criteria to me for a thumbs-up show. But there was also some really bad stuff on this show. I thought the Stephanie McMahon-Paul Heyman segment was just absolute garbage. I got what they were trying to accomplish, but they could have shaved 10 minutes off this thing easily and achieved the same result, which is, A, Stephanie is the alpha female on Raw, and the alpha male, too, because her balls are bigger than everybody else's, and everybody must cower in her presence, and that also she doesn't really care that Brock Lesnar assaulted her brother. This is to further the whole Raw versus SmackDown dynamic. But they took forever to get there. And in fact, this may have been my least favorite segment involving Paul Heyman since he came back to WWE. This will not make my list of the top 9 promos in WWE history, put it that way. I did get a kick out of Heyman trying to pay Lesnar's $500 fine in singles. That was funny, but that aside, I just thought this was so boring. This was just so boring. Speaking of Stephanie, multiple times on this show, she referred to them crowning the first ever Universal Champion in the main event that night. Now, the first time she said that, I just figured she misspoke. Okay, people make mistakes, it happens. But then she did it again. She did it in a pre-tape, backstage. It's like, poor Finn Balor. It's bad enough he's got to sit at home for the next 6 to 8 months. Now Stephanie's all like, Finn who? Finn who? Remember Royal Rumble 92? When Hogan and Sid were going at it after the match, and Sid points to a sign in the crowd that says, Hulk who? Right? Finn who? That's what I thought here. The Titus O'Neil, Darren Young stuff has got to be the worst feud of the year. They had a match that Titus just dominated. He absolutely dominated this match. But he still lost. Darren rolled him up with a crucifix and pinned him 1-2-3. A fluke finish. And then Titus laid him out. He laid out Bob Backlund. So what exactly was accomplished here? To make Titus more of a heel? I might agree if anyone actually gave a shit about any of this, which they don't. They had a 6-person tag team match with Bayley and the New Day against Gallows and Anderson and Dana Brooke. And Bayley was super over. She pinned Dana with the belly to Bayley and she danced with the New Day. And on commentary, Charlotte said there was only so much that she could do to help Dana. Ain't that the damn truth? If ever there was like a shoot statement there on commentary, there it is. There was one person who sent me a message. He was very upset that, you know, 1 week into her debut and they have Bayley dancing with the New Day. Like somehow this hurt Bayley. Like this hurt her persona or something. Bayley is childlike. She comes out dancing with giant inflatable tube men, okay? Dancing with the New Day is exactly the sort of thing that I would expect Bayley to do, so I don't have a problem with it. Now, one person who was not happy to see Gallows and Anderson teaming with Dana Brooke was Luke Gallows' wife, the former Bullet Babe, Amber O'Neill, whose name on her Twitter was actually listed as Amber O'Neill Gallows, but after Monday, it's now just listed as Amber O'Neill. Okay, whatever that might mean. She was asked about Dana Brooke. People were tweeting her, what do you think about Dana teaming with your husband and Anderson? And her first, she went on a tweet storm. Her first response was, am I going to have to kill a bitch? Then later she amended it with, actually, let me reprise that, or rephrase that, she said. I would kill a bitch if I cared enough to do it, but in this case, I'll just let them have her. Hashtag trash. She tweeted a whole bunch of other things. She used the hashtag Miss Piggy in reference to Dana. And then by the next day, she had pulled the old tweet and delete and took them all down. If I were Dana, I would have eyes in the back of my head. Okay, if she was just trying to work like an angle or something here, I don't know what that possibly could have accomplished other than getting heat on her husband, so probably a good idea that she deleted all of those tweets. That just came off as very stupid to me. I mentioned Jericho and Neville had a match. They had a really good match. Thankfully, Neville's ankle survived this time. Jericho won with an old school lion tamer, which looks as brutal today as it did in WCW when he used it. Sheamus has beaten Cesaro now to take a 2-0 lead in their best of 7 series. Sheamus backdrops Cesaro into the ring post. Outside the ring, the what sounds like plastic ring post now. and then immediately rolled him into the ring and slapped on the cloverleaf for the tap out. So I thought that was a cool spot, and they're selling it like Cesaro suffered a back injury, which he didn't. And it places Cesaro now, the babyface, at a disadvantage. He's got to come from behind to get the win, so if they have any brain cells left, that's exactly how this thing will play out. Cesaro will come from behind, he'll win it in 6 or 7 matches, and then he'll get a championship match. Braun Strowman beat an American luchador named Americo. This was child abuse. If Americo was 5 feet, I would be shocked. Strowman pulled off Americo's mask after the match, and the fans actually booed. So the fans in Houston were very mindful of how insulting such an act is in Lucha Libre. They were offended when he pulled off this guy's mask. I'm now waiting for Americo's dad, Mr. Americo, to debut this Monday. You know, have Strowman pull the mask off, or have Mr. Americo pull the mask off, and he reveals it's Hogan underneath, right? It's his big return, and then before Strowman can kill him, out comes Kaz and Enzo, and Kaz gives him the big boot right out of the ring, and so you set up Big Cass as the first guy to really step up to Braun Strowman, and then they compose with Hogan in the ring. I literally just came up with that last part. I'm sure they'll come up with something bigger for Hogan's eventual return. You know it's coming. Like making him an honorary member of New Day or something. But hey, it's just an idea. Let's talk about how great this main event was, shall we? I absolutely love the way they promoted this thing throughout the entire show. They had individual video packages for each of the four guys in the match. They really made them each feel like a big deal. Big cast, too. Like, they really wanted you to get behind this guy and wanted you to see him win that championship. I love the opening segment even of the show with Corey Graves in the ring interviewing all of them. They were all sitting down and then the Fatal 4-Way itself. Just such a fun match. Big Cass was the first one eliminated. But you know, sometimes they say you can come away much stronger in defeat than you can in winning. This was a textbook example of that. Him winning the title this early would have been a huge mistake. He's not ready for it. The fans would have revolted against him the way they did with Roman Reigns. Within a few months, I guarantee you they would have revolted against him. It would have been the worst thing they could have done for him, was to put the title on him this early. Because there may come a time where, you know, hey, Big Cass is WWE champion or whatever, Universal champion. Now is not that time. But even though he lost, he came away as one of the big stars of this match. Crowd was behind him. He looked strong. He didn't look out of place. It took everybody hitting a big move on him to put him down, the Superman punch, and then Seth kicked him, and then Owens, you know, came off the top with a frog splash, and finally they pinned him. So Cass lost nothing in losing here. This was the biggest night of his career, and I thought he looked great. So we get to the end. Kevin Owens must have taken no less than 5 or 6 Superman punches from Roman Reigns, so now he's outside the ring. Rollins and Reigns are outside on the other side of the ring. Triple H returns. He pedigrees Roman Reigns on the floor. He rolls him back inside. He puts Seth back in. Seth pins Roman, which has sort of become his thing now. And now we're down to 2. Triple H puts Kevin Owens in the ring. And just when we're supposed to believe that it's all over for Kevin Owens, Triple H turns around and he pedigrees Seth Rollins. And by the way, big ups to Seth Rollins for taking that pedigree like a champ. Roman Reigns did too, although I noticed he got his hands down right before he hit the floor. And again, he got pedigreed on the floor, so if that were me, I'm putting my hands down too. But in the ring, Rollins took that move old school, which maybe, I don't know if anybody else noticed, maybe nobody cared, but I noticed. Kevin Owens now has a look on his face of shock. He can't believe what he's seeing. He steals the pin, and Kevin Owens becomes the new Universal Champion. And by the way, were there really people thinking Kevin Owens wasn't clued in on that finish? I don't know, I saw tweets about it, and people went, oh, maybe Kevin Owens didn't know. Like, really? Kevin Owens didn't know? Like, I don't know where you would get that from, but anyway. Believe me, Kevin Owens knew. He sold it, though, like he had no idea what was going on. I guess you can give him an Academy Award, then, if you bought into the fact that he might not have known the finish, because he was acting like he didn't know. And Triple H handed him the title, and it all had a very SummerSlam 2013 vibe to it. And, you know, just the big swerve with Triple H pedigreeing someone and essentially handing the title to the new handpicked guy. If you remember when they did the swerve with Randy Orton and Daniel Bryan at SummerSlam that year, I raved about it. I thought it was great. I thought it shook things up. It was something different. I didn't see it coming. The crowd went crazy for it. It felt somewhat fresh. I can say that after 3 years, I was ready to pull my hair out with all the Authority bullshit. It just went on for way too long. But I love the swerve, and I love this one too. I didn't see it coming, and now Kevin Owens is the new champion. And I said on this podcast last week, my prediction was Kevin Owens. I wanted Kevin Owens to win. I predicted Kevin Owens would win, and I did that for three reasons. He's popular, he can wrestle, and he can talk. So why the hell not? Why not? Take a chance on the guy. And that's what they did, and I applaud them for it. It sucks what happened to Finn Balor, but you know what? You need to make the most of it. When shit like that happens, you make the most of it. And they got everybody talking. Everybody's talking about this, okay? Now, you have people who were not so happy coming out of this. They feel Kevin Owens was made to look weak by the fact that Triple H, you know, essentially was the one who did all the work. And he gifted him the win. And all of that is true. That's exactly what happened. Triple H basically eliminated two men. He eliminated two of the top stars in the company, Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins, each by himself with one pedigree. But it's Triple H. Are we really surprised when stuff like this happens? It's in 2016. I mean, come on. You need to watch these shows with the understanding that it's always, and I do mean always, about the McMahons. Triple H is part of that family now. He is a McMahon. It has always been about them. It always will be about them. Everybody else, the faces may change, but they're always secondary. Now, with Owens, I look at it like this. The guy's a heel. It doesn't matter if some people cheer him and they chant, "You deserve it," when he wins the title, which they did at the end of the show. They respect him, but he's still a heel. He's a heel who wins by any means necessary. He's a guy who power bombs his best friend on the ring apron. And then later on says, "I can't understand why Sammy wasn't happy for me when I got called up to the main roster first." The guy's a sociopath. He has no conscience. He doesn't care how he wins, just so long as he wins. So him stealing the pin on Rollins, it didn't really bother me. If it were me, the way I would have done it, maybe I wouldn't have even done it that way, but after that happened, what I would have loved to have seen, I would have had him and Triple H, you know, they're celebrating, they leave the ring together, and have Owens do to Triple H exactly what he did to Sami Zayn in NXT. He attacks Triple H, right, to show his gratitude for what Triple H had just done for him. Because he already won the belt, he doesn't need the guy anymore. Triple H ain't the GM, he's not the commissioner. He powerbombs Triple H on the ring apron, just to show, I don't need your help, I did it all by myself. It's like when Owen Hart won the King of the Ring in 94, right? Jim Neidhart came out and helped him win. But when he did that speech, if I remember correctly, Owen was saying, I did it all by myself. It's the same thing. In fact, that's where the Owens name comes from. He named his son Owen after Owen Hart. That's what it reminds me of. It's the same thing. It's the same logic here. So I would have loved to have seen him powerbomb Triple H on the apron and let Triple H go away for a while. But, you know, that would require them to allow someone to get one over on the McMahons, and that's just not going to happen. Now, what I'm more worried about is making sure that this doesn't become the Authority 2.0. I don't want to see that. That is not something I have any interest in seeing. We got 3 years of that shit, which was honestly 2 years more than we needed. And, you know, if the idea is just to have Kevin Owens doing Triple H's bidding like a little lapdog and play the role of Randy Orton, it's like now playing the role of Seth Rollins from 2014. To me, if they do that, that's just lazy writing. That's all it is. It's just lazy writing, and it's not something Kevin Owens ought to be doing. He should be out for himself. He should not be out for anyone else. There's been ideas floated. Maybe it's like part of an NXT invasion, right? Triple H is supporting one of his NXT kids. You know, it sounds cool in theory, but who are they gonna do it with? You know, if the story is that Triple H is backing all of his so-called NXT kids in some sort of revolt against guys like Rollins and Reigns, I mean, does that mean Sami Zayn goes heel and aligns with Kevin Owens? Right? Does that mean Neville joins them? Or Bo Dallas, if you can pull him away from the airport bar long enough? I don't really see how that would work. I think. The more likely reason that we get for Triple H turning on Seth Rollins is very simple. It's going to be that Rollins let him down. He let him down by getting hurt last year. He let him down by letting Dean Ambrose cash in Money in the Bank and beat him. He let him down by losing to Finn Balor at SummerSlam and then putting Balor out with an injury, which fucked up all their plans. Maybe you could even weave that part in there if you want to. At every turn, Seth Rollins has let him down. And on top of that, he has sullied his own great maneuver, the pedigree. He bestowed that move onto him, and now he is ashamed to have done that. I think it may end up being something along those lines, as far as what their explanation is. I'm hoping it's the start of a long overdue face turn for Seth Rollins. I don't expect him to walk out on Monday and be a baby. I mean, he may get cheered, but I don't expect him to come out and act like a baby face on Monday. I think it's something that's just gradually going to happen, but it's the right move to make. Someone asked me, do I think Rollins stays heel and maybe Kevin Owens becomes the baby face? I hope not. I think that would be a mistake. I think he's too good as a heel. Kevin Owens at some point will be a baby face, but right now, he's just so goddamn good as a heel. And it shouldn't be the end of Jericho either. I don't want to see those two split up. I still want them to do stuff together. Maybe Jericho can kind of be out there sometimes backing him up or something. The question is, what do they do with the next pay-per-view, right? So they have the first Raw brand pay-per-view is September 25th. So they have a few weeks. Clash of Champions, what do you do with that show? Now, last week, I suggested that Kevin Owens wins the title, and you have him defend against Sami Zayn. Sami is doing nothing right now. He beat fucking Jinder Mahal on this show. But he does have that win over Kevin Owens at Battleground. So if he's not the first guy out on Raw Monday night to challenge Kevin Owens, then something's wrong. Okay, but the fact is, Seth Rollins was robbed. He was robbed. He does have a claim to a rematch. And Mick Foley and Stephanie McMahon seem very upset after what happened on the show. So my expectation is that it's going to be Seth Rollins against Roman Reigns at the Clash of Champions. Mr. PWI 500 got screwed also, but I think Roman's getting Rusev for the U.S. title on the next pay-per-view. So I can envision a situation here where maybe Mick Foley makes a match tomorrow night between Rollins and Reigns one-on-one. The winner faces Kevin Owens at the pay-per-view, and Rusev interferes. He helps Rollins get the win. I could see it kind of going down like that. Ultimately, we're going to get Triple H against Seth Rollins. This is a match that was rumored for WrestleMania this year before Rollins got hurt. It's a match they've been building to for a while, very subtly. There's been, even back when the Authority was in power and Seth was their boy, there was a lot of underlying tension and little hints they were dropping that something was going to go down at some point between Triple H and Seth Rollins. And then he got hurt and it kind of delayed things. But we're going to get this match. It's inevitable. It's a match that should not happen, I don't think, until Toronto at the Survivor Series. I mean, really, it's a match that should be saved for WrestleMania, but there's a long time between now and WrestleMania. I don't know if they could wait that long. We'll see what they do. We'll see what they do. But what they've done here is they've created a ton of interest in this show tomorrow night. To find out what happens next, it's like a big cliffhanger. And they put the title on somebody who I think is more than capable of carrying it. We'll find out, I guess, in a few months if he's just a quick transitional champion, or we'll find out if he's a flop or if he gets himself more over in the process. But if you're going to take a chance on someone new, Kevin Owens really hasn't been around for that long. He only made his debut on the main roster last year, so he's still a relatively new guy. He's still a relatively new face. If you're going to give anybody a chance, he's as good a person as any. So I was very happy to see them put the title on him, and now hopefully it's not a one-and-done type of thing, and they'll let him run with it for a while. SmackDown. The SmackDown roster is down a man, if the latest reports are to be believed. And I called this one weeks ago after he and Paige were both suspended. I said that I thought this was it for Alberto Del Rio and WWE. I didn't think we were going to see him back, and that appears to be the case. Del Rio has been pulled from the advertising for all the live events after his suspension ends. Reportedly, he and WWE have come to terms on his release, even though it hasn't officially been announced yet. And he will be allowed to go back to working pretty much anywhere he wants. He was said to be very unhappy with his position and promises that were made for a main event push that never happened. And very clearly that was not going to happen. And you know, I just got done talking about the Ryback stuff earlier. And again, throw Del Rio on that list. Broken promises, told one thing, and for whatever reason, it just doesn't pan out, right? Ryback left for the same reason. He claimed he got tired of being lied to. When Punk left WWE, all those times Vince would tell him, "I owe you one, pal." So he's not the first person to be upset by broken promises. Here's the thing with Del Rio. Before he left WWE the first time, he bored me to tears. I know he had a lot of friends there, like John Cena. He was very well liked. People liked working with him, and he's a good wrestler. But he bored me to fucking tears by the end of his run, okay? Especially after they took away the car, and they took away the ring announcer, and all of that stuff. He was just a dude on the roster. So when he left, all of a sudden, he created a real buzz for himself. At one point, he was working for AAA, Ring of Honor, and Lucha Underground. And he was getting great reactions. This guy was in demand. And then he was unhappy that, I guess, he was unhappy with some creative decisions in Lucha Underground. And he left. And he came back to WWE. And the night he came back and he beat John Cena, he felt like a big deal. He came out to a big reaction. He kicked John Cena in the head. He took the U.S. title from him. And it was like, wow, this guy is off to the races. Physically, he looks different. He looks like a new man. He looked like he was chiseled out of stone or something. He had this great tan. He was all ripped. You know, I guess it must be all the salads he was eating. But he came back, and right off the bat, he's off to a hot start. Except for one thing. And that is the fact that they put Zeb Coulter with him, which never made any sense at all. I mean, you talk about two polar opposites. And the last time we saw Del Rio in the company, he was feuding with Zeb Coulter. He was feuding with Jack Swagger and Zeb Coulter. And so now, all of a sudden, they put Zeb Coulter with Alberto Del Rio. And, you know, wouldn't you know it, it didn't work out. It flopped. Who knew? Who knew that aligning this badass Mexican dude with Yosemite Sam wouldn't work? So after that, it was just a steady decline. It was a steady decline in interest in the guy, a steady decline in his status on the show. They didn't do anything with him. They put him in the League of Nations, which was something, I guess. But he went from having a real superstar aura about him to just being another guy on the roster, which is exactly the position he was in when he first left the company. And you know, maybe he bears part of the blame for that. Maybe you can't put all of that on the company. But it's all about positioning, right? They never gave us a reason to care about this guy. El Patron, he was cool. Del Rio was not cool. So it's for the better. He can go, he can be a headliner somewhere else instead of just being another body on the roster. Now, I also saw that Mr. St. Laurent, I think his name is, from the MLW, one of the MLW radio shows. I don't know how reliable he is with this stuff, but he claims that Mark Carano, who works in talent relations for WWE, has been harassing Del Rio and Paige about ending their relationship. The WWE wants them to end things. The fact that they were drafted to different brands was not a coincidence, he says. No shit, it wasn't a coincidence. It was pretty obvious that WWE did not want the two of them together. That's why one went to Raw and one went to SmackDown. I don't think they broke anybody else up. I mean, you knew when Nikki came back she was going to SmackDown because that's where Cena is. They kept Naomi on the same brand with Jimmy Uso. They kept Lana and Rusev obviously on the same brand. Miz and Maryse, and you can go up and down the line here. But they split those two up. That was not a coincidence. That was not random. They didn't put their names on the randomized generator to see who's going to Raw and who's going to SmackDown. So it's very obvious they didn't want the two of them together. My whole philosophy is live and let live, right? Unless they're causing problems. It's like when the news first came out that these two were dating, and Del Rio's like 37 or something, and she's 24, and people are like, oh, the age difference. I'm like, who cares? Who gives a shit? You know what I mean? Like, maybe if he was 50 and she was 20, okay, that's ridiculous. But who cares? You know, like, unless they're causing problems backstage, it's none of their business if the two of them want to date each other. I mean, if they enforce the strict policy of no dating between employees, no dating between performers, that would be one thing. But you can go up, you can make a whole fucking laundry list of everybody who's in a relationship in that company right now. People who have gotten married. So, there is no rule against dating your coworker. So again, unless they're causing problems, who cares? They're two consenting adults, two consenting independent contractors, mind you. Vince's own daughter married one of the wrestlers, for Christ's sake. So to me, I hear that, and it's just all petty nonsense. SmackDown, Instapoll, over 1,800 votes, 74% thumbs up, 26% thumbs down. They didn't really spend much time at all on the Miz Daniel Bryan stuff, you know, to follow up on what happened on Talking Smack the week before. They had a little bit of banter at the beginning of the show between Bryan and Shane McMahon backstage, and Bryan didn't really talk about it until Talking Smack after this show. He claims that WWE doesn't want any more interaction between the two of them for a while, almost like they weren't expecting it to get quite that heated. But to me, it just makes sense to keep them apart, because if it's not building to a match, all you're doing is promoting a match that's never going to happen. And if Daniel Bryan was ever going to come back for one more match, I can think of at least 10 people other than the fucking Miz who I want to see him in the ring with. And one of them right now is the NXT champion. Okay, so instead what they've done is they've taken Dolph Ziggler and effectively they've planted him in the role of Daniel Bryan. He's almost like Bryan's surrogate in a way to oppose the Miz. He's on the show, he's saying the same things that Bryan was about him being a coward. They had a very heated exchange in the ring at the start of the show, and Ziggler challenged him to a fight. Miz backed off. So that looks to be your Intercontinental title match at Backlash next weekend. Yes, we have another pay-per-view next Sunday. AJ Styles. AJ Styles is just absolutely... I was going to say phenomenal, but that would be too cliche. He's absolutely fantastic as the cocky asshole walking around wearing John Cena's armband around his head. He beat Apollo Crews. That was not even the best thing he did on this show. That actually would come later on. I love the skit between Renee Young. Well, it was Renee Young interviewing Heath Slater and Rhino in what was supposed to be Heath's trailer home. And skits like this can be hit or miss. Generally speaking, I like them. I wish they would do more of them, like these off-site kind of things. I tell you, this is what I thought they were going to do with Darren Young and Bob Backlund when they started doing the stuff with the two of them. That's why I soured on it so quickly, because I had high hopes, right? I love Bob Backlund. And I thought they had some real comedic potential there to take these two guys like off-site and do funny things with them. And what they did with them was so unoriginal. It was so just by week six of the stupid split screen of them in the same studio, because you know they were, it was like they clearly don't have any ideas on what to do here. Like they have something that they could either turn into something legitimately funny or make it so bad that it's funny. Like I talked about Fuji Vice earlier, and they did nothing. It was so unoriginal and it was so uncreative. It was so stupid. And of course now it's just a dead act. But this I enjoyed. This I enjoyed. There was a woman named Beulah playing the role of Heath's wife. She served them cheese and crackers, which Rhino was more than happy to partake in. He said absolutely nothing. He spoke and said nothing the entire time. He just made these facial expressions. At one point when Renee was asking Slater about getting killed on Raw that time by Brock Lesnar, they zoomed in on Rhino making a sad face on one of the crackers with the Cheese Whiz. I laughed out loud. Just put the titles on these two already. These two guys are great. They wrestled the returning Headbangers, Mosh and Thrasher, as part of this tag team title tournament. Either nobody knew or nobody cared about the Headbangers or who they were. The fact that they changed their fucking music, I'm sure, didn't help. What was the point of that, by the way? Can you explain that to me? Why do they see the need to do that when certain guys come back? They did that with Bret Hart. Bret Hart came back to the company for the first time in 12 years. This monumental return you thought you would never see on Monday Night Raw. And his music hits, you hear that guitar riff, and it goes into this weird fucking guitar mix that kind of, like, people are at first are like, ooh, like, what is that? It's like, at least for the first appearance, can you just play his old music? Is it really that difficult? You want to come up with some new mix for him after the fact, then that's fine. But I hear this, like, generic crappy, and look, the Headbangers music before was just generic crappy music, too. But I don't know. It's just, it's like, it's a minor thing, but like I hear that and I'm like, why did they change their music? Maybe there are some people in the crowd who would remember them, but they won't remember them necessarily if they hear this crappy music. And who knows if it'll even be back. I mean, talk about making new music for them. Who the hell even knows? This might have just been a one-off. I'll tell you what, they messed up Heath Slater's face, and Mosh busted Rhino open above the eye. He had a nasty gash. He needed 8 stitches to close it. I mean, talk about giving a new meaning to the term headbangers. So who the hell knows if these guys will even be back? The headbangers, I'm sure, already have heat with Bret Hart. And it was weird, too, because Slater, basically, Heath Slater wrestled the entire match. Rhino only tagged in for the finish. And I couldn't figure out at first, like, how it happened. How did he get busted open so badly? So I rewound it. I went back, and it looked to me like Mosh, what happened is Mosh ran into the ring. Rhino's out on the apron. Mosh comes in, and he runs over and punches Rhino, like, to knock Rhino off the apron. And that was it. He just, like, punched him in the head. And I tell you what, that must have been one hell of a punch. So when Rhino tagged in to hit the gore, half his face was already covered in blood. Heath had blood on him from Rhino. I mean, he took a hell of a shot. So they got the win. Slater and Rhino did. They advanced to the semifinals. They will meet the Hype Bros. The Usos will meet American Alpha. Remember what I pitched. I'm still hoping for an Usos turn, either, you know, this Tuesday or at Backlash. I predict American Alpha advances, and the Usos end up costing them the titles in some way at the pay-per-view. Which means Rhino and Slater win the titles, and Heath Slater would earn himself a SmackDown contract. So that's how I see this playing out. That's how I hope it plays out. There was a boring segment with Bray Wyatt and Randy Orton to set up their match at Backlash. I do like Bray, but I'm kind of over these promo segments with him. Before the main event, there was a guy in the ring calling himself Gary the Milkman Millman, who said that he was given the chance to wrestle tonight and he wanted his opponent to come down to the ring. And out came Kane, who killed him with a chokeslam and left. He left without his ring post pyro because their new LED ring posts don't support shooting flames out of them. So maybe they ought to take them back to the store and get a refund. And then I almost had a heart attack because Baron Corbin was making his way down to the ring for the main event against Dean Ambrose. And he and Kane crossed paths. And the announcers made mention of it. And this seemed to foreshadow an eventual match between them. Remind me to skip SmackDown that week when that match happens. Baron Corbin and Kane. That sounds like something nightmares are afraid of. Dean Ambrose and Baron Corbin. Every week that goes by, I realize this Ambrose thing, it just ain't working. I don't know if it's just who they're putting him with or if it's Ambrose himself, but they got to get that title off him and put it on AJ Styles ASAP. Styles was ringside for commentary. He tried to kick Ambrose, but he hit Corbin instead. Ambrose was DQ'd, which means that Baron Corbin defeated Dean Ambrose. Ambrose gave Corbin dirty deeds. AJ went to attempt a phenomenal forearm, but Ambrose crotched him on the top rope, and Styles had this look on his face like his fourth child would probably be his last. And straddling the top rope is where he stayed until they went off the air. Ambrose kind of like patted him on the shoulder and shook his head and got his title and he left. That was the finish. It's as though the SmackDown writing team got to the end of the script and just gave up. So Styles stayed in that position for a good 5 to 10 minutes after they went off the air. Quite possibly the greatest sell of a nut shot in history. John Cena came out for the dark match main event. Styles was still straddling the top rope. Roman Reigns came out. Styles was still straddling the top rope. Seth Rollins came out. Styles was still straddling the top rope. And I realized watching this, like, AJ Styles is the closest thing they've got to Kurt Angle. I'm talking like 2000, 2001 Kurt Angle. He is the best, clearly the best wrestler in the entire company. But he can also play the goofy comedy really well. So they've got an MVP player in this guy. And the quicker they get that championship on him, the better. So Raw versus SmackDown this week. SmackDown is a much easier show to watch, but I'm going to give the edge to Raw. I thought Raw was the better wrestling show, much better matches, and let's be honest here, nothing was going to top that finish. I mean, you compare Kevin Owens winning the Universal Championship, a big swerve, this great 20-plus minute match to AJ Styles, funny as it was, straddling the top rope. Yeah, I don't think SmackDown was winning this week.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week, I just thought this show was a total bore. It's just a very boring show. Ty Dillinger beat Buddy Murphy. We had a Tommaso Ciampa interview, or as Steve Austin said, Tommasino Ciampa. He had an interview with him backstage. The Revival attacked him, and they beat him up from the back all the way into the ring. Johnny Gargano was selling a knee injury. He wasn't there. Clearly, they're building to a split with Gargano at some point. They had footage of him, you know, tapping out at TakeOver and tapping out in the Cruiserweight Classic, almost like portraying him as the weak link of their team. So they beat the hell out of Ciampa. They were cutting a promo. Ciampa got back up. He was smiling at them. They laid him out with the Shatter Machine. We had Steve Cutler and Kenneth Crawford. Yeah, two guys that I'm sure you've never heard of before. They had a match. Cutler won with the Fisherman Suplex Driver. Crawford looked pretty impressive here. He even busted out a running Shooting Star Press at one point. You know, he's a guy I wouldn't mind seeing more of. Steve Cutler, we've seen Cutler before. Usually he's the guy who's coming out there as like the job guy doing the J-O-B. Here he actually got a win, so it looks like they're trying to do something with him. He's one of the guys, I guess, that's been at the PC for a long time. He's still, I made this comment once before, Cutler still reminds me of Ron Perlman, but with mutton chops. The people who still think Steve Cutler looks like me need to get their eyes checked. I hope you people were not approved for your driver's license. If so, tell me please where you live, and I will make sure I am not on the road when you are. No Way Jose beat the Baker, Angelo Dawkins. I was very happy to see Corey Graves back up what I've been saying for months now. He saw Angelo Dawkins doing that stupid stir-in-the-pot motion with his hands, and he had no idea what he was doing. Mixing cake batter was the best that Corey Graves could come up with. What I want him to do, I want him to start wearing a baker's hat and an apron to the ring. Just go full out with this gimmick. Andrade Cien Almas was doing an interview in the back when Austin Aries interrupted him while eating a banana. He said Hideo Itami busted his eardrum at TakeOver. Bret Hart will not be pleased. Almas started yelling at him in Spanish and then challenged him to a match next week, and Banana Boy said that he couldn't hear him because of his busted eardrum and he walked off. They've now started the process of rebuilding the women's division in NXT because after Asuka, let's be honest here, the well runs dry. Okay, remember those first Glacier promos in WCW? Blood runs cold. The well runs dry with the NXT women's division. The glory days have come to an end. We had Liv Morgan against Aaliyah. Morgan won with a kick that may not have connected. I don't know. They shot it from a bad angle. I would imagine they shot it from that angle for a reason. The crowd at one point started a Jersey chant because Liv Morgan is from New Jersey. They started a Jersey chant in Florida. And as Corey Graves said, there's a lot of weird people in Florida. Noah Mark lives in Florida. I rest my case. And the main event was Shinsuke Nakamura making his debut appearance as the new NXT champion here at Full Sail University. He said that he had faced the best from Sami Zayn to Finn Balor and finally Samoa Joe, and now he was the champion. And the title means more than any other title that he's ever held. The Joe era is over, he said, and now it is time for the era of strong style. And Bret Hart strongly disapproves of this. And that was it. Asuka returns next week, so they're hyping her return. But, you know, they're in rebuilding mode right now. It's very obvious that they've lost a lot of talent on the male and the female side, and they've brought in some new faces, and they're trying to rebuild this show. And unfortunately, when you're trying to rebuild, it's going to make for some boring shows along the way, and this was a hell of a boring show. So, and by the way, if you hear any noise in the background, apparently Senor Benjamin is cutting the fucking grass back there, so you'll have to excuse me. Hopefully Vanguard 1 is giving him directions out there as he does that. I'll tell you what wasn't a boring show this week, the Cruiserweight Classic. This was a fantastic show. We had Gran Metalik beating Akira Tozawa with the Michinoku Driver. I guess they call it the Metalik Driver. Metalik, it's hard to describe like all the moves and all the back and forth here. I'm not going to get into that. But Tozawa, his big move is the German suplex, right? Nobody does a better German suplex than Akira Tozawa. That's what they've told us. Metalik kicked out of it after he hit it. And so he went for another one, Tozawa did, but Metalik powered out and he was able to counter it into the driver and got the win. This was just a really fun match. And I was really bummed to see Akira Tozawa get bounced, but if there's any justice, they either have already signed him or they will sign him for the Cruiserweight division and they'll get him on Raw. Or at least get him to NXT, because I really would like to see more of him. And the only other match on the show was Kota Ibushi against the Brian Kendrick. So it was a two-match show, so between the promo packages and everything building up these matches, the matches themselves were great, but so was the build-up to them, but none better than this match here. The story they told in this match, I mean, there were multiple stories going on here. So the main story of the Kota Ibushi-Brian Kendrick match was, Brian Kendrick is the old veteran, you know, 37 can be considered old, which I guess here it would be, and this may be his last chance. He sees this as his final opportunity. If he gets bounced, if he loses this thing, he loses everything. This is his last shot at glory. And Daniel Bryan has been singing this guy's praises on commentary. He doesn't even hide the bias on commentary. You know, him and Kendrick had their very first match together ever in a pro wrestling ring. They go back many years to, you know, the days when they came up with Shawn Michaels at the old Texas Wrestling Academy. So Bryan has been behind Kendrick every week, every match. Kendrick has made it this far. So that's kind of the main story. But then in the match itself, very early on, we see Kendrick, and this is something I've never seen before. They're on the apron. So you have the ring post is between them. Kendrick is on one side of it, and Ibushi is on the other side of it on the apron. And Kendrick gives Ibushi a neck breaker on the metal, not the turnbuckle itself, but kind of the metal portion that sticks out. The metal portion that connects the buckle to the post. And, of course, Kota Ibushi had pretty major neck surgery. I don't think it was this year. It might have been earlier this year. It actually could have been earlier this year or last year, but he had major neck surgery. And so now he does this move, and it's like, oh, the surgically repaired neck. And so that now becomes the other story that they tell throughout the match, is that Kendrick is working over the neck. Ibushi keeps favoring the neck. So you had multiple things going on here at once. Kendrick nearly killed Ibushi with the Burning Hammer. And this is not the WWE version of the Burning Hammer that Tyler Rex used to do. Okay, until John Cena chewed him out one day in front of everybody for using it because, you know, it's too close to the attitude adjustment. This was the real version of the Burning Hammer. And I could see why we've never seen it in WWE. And it almost feels wrong that it wasn't the finish and that Ibushi kicked out of it, but this was just absolutely brutal. He basically gets Ibushi on his shoulders, almost like in a torture rack position, and then just tosses him off, and Ibushi lands, just folded up like an accordion, and just lands right on the back of his neck, right on the back of his head and neck. Bryan on commentary is going nuts, the Burning Hammer, and he goes for the cover, and Ibushi kicks out, and the place is going nuts. And the thing is, before the Burning Hammer, Kendrick had used the Bully Choke on Ibushi. The Bully Choke is the move that he used to win his first match in the tournament. So he uses the Bully Choke here. Ibushi gets out of it, okay? So later on, and I love the psychology of this. Ibushi missed a Phoenix Splash later in the match, off the top rope. He just crashed and burned. He missed the Phoenix Splash. As soon as Ibushi splattered on the mat, Kendrick locked him in the Bully Choke again. And you actually thought for a few seconds there that Kota Ibushi would tap out to Brian Kendrick. For the sake of the story that they were telling, and because, you know, he got out of it the first time, they made you believe that he might actually tap out to this move. But then Ibushi rolled through, and then he kicked Kendrick in the head, and he powerbombed him for the win. And then I realize how stupid of me to think that they would put Brian Kendrick over Kota Ibushi in this tournament. But that's the beauty of it, right? They got me to believe, even if only for a few seconds. For 5 seconds, they got me to believe. I mean, that's one of the things I love so much about that Shawn Michaels Undertaker match at WrestleMania 25. If only for a few seconds on that last super kick, they got me to think that Shawn Michaels might just beat the streak. And then he didn't, and then Taker tombstoned him and beat him. And that's what happened here. Ibushi got out of it, he hit the Golden Star Powerbomb, and he got the win. And that's just, it's what I love about pro wrestling. I mean, they really, they got me here in this match. And on top of everything, it was just a great fucking match. So after the match, Brian Kendrick is all emotional, tears in his eyes, because he's now been eliminated from this tournament, his dream is over, his hopes have been dashed. Daniel Bryan comes down from the commentary booth, he gets in the ring, he's crying, he embraces Kendrick, this big emotional scene, and that's how they go off the air. This was one of the best shows, one of the best 60-minute shows of wrestling that you'll see all year. This was great. This was great. And it makes me sad to think that this thing is coming to an end very soon. Now, this Wednesday, they're going to have Zack Sabre Jr. against Noam Dar and Rich Swann against TJ Perkins. I'm looking forward to that match a lot. But we've only got 2 episodes left. We've got, you know, that, and then we've got the live finale on September 14th. And then the Cruiserweight division comes to Raw on September 19th. TNA, a few notes here on TNA and ROH and Lucha Underground real quick. TNA, apparently Final Deletion 2 is coming this week on Impact. It is Delete or Decay. Even the Raw general manager couldn't help but tweet an advertisement for it. And then he claimed it was an accident. Sure it was, Mick. Sure it was. I just love the fact that Foley didn't delete it after he put it up. He still, last I checked, it was still up there. This just giant poster. Watch Impact, September 8th. And I don't blame him either. Matt Hardy may be the most entertaining man in wrestling at the moment. And if Mick Foley has any sense, or if he actually had any real power as the Raw GM, which he doesn't, he would sign Hardy and Vanguard 1 as soon as they're free. Ring of Honor, I just wanted to mention this. I am hoping to get back into the Ring of Honor reviews soon. I want to thank the person who reminded me that I can watch the weekly ROH show through the Fight TV app, the F-I-T-E app that I see Jim Ross promoting sometimes. It's all on there, and it plays, and it works like a charm, and so that might make it easier for me to check out the show, so thank you for that. And Lucha Underground is coming back this week. This is a quick turnaround. Is this season 3? I think it's season 3, premieres this Wednesday. So next weekend on the Sound Off, we will resume the Lucha Underground reviews, and I cannot wait. So that covers pretty much all the important news. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can please include your name and where you are from when you email me. I would very much appreciate that. First of all, I got a lot of questions from people asking me my thoughts on what Vince Russo had to say about Kevin Owens winning the Universal title and how him winning the title shows that wrestling has hit rock bottom and apparently wrestling sucks and David Arquette was more over than Kevin Owens, whatever the hell that's even supposed to mean. But I'm going to keep this brief, okay? My thoughts are I have no thoughts about what Vince Russo thinks about Kevin Owens winning the title other than this. I read what he said. And I read what Jim Cornette had to say, because Cornette has his own issues in the past with Kevin Owens, and people wanted to know what he was going to have to say. Cornette was not exactly fond of Owens after working with him in Ring of Honor, but as he pointed out, he did put the title on him at one point, so it's not as though he didn't see something in the guy. I guess he just didn't like his attitude. And when Cornette finally put out a statement about him winning the championship here, okay, because people kept asking him about it, he said he really didn't care about someone winning a title that he doesn't care about on a show that he doesn't watch. But he kept it brief, and he said he's happy for anyone who is a Kevin Owens fan and anyone who wants to see the guy succeed. So Cornette is not always the most eloquent person in the world, but I thought that that was a perfectly respectful thing for him to say. Russo, who also claimed he didn't really care, went on a whole diatribe and wouldn't shut the fuck up about it. So beyond what I just said, I honestly don't give a shit what Vince Russo thinks about Kevin Owens winning the Universal title. Faik from Pakistan. I heard your podcast last week, and I couldn't help but notice you said the idea of Finn Balor beating Brock Lesnar is laughable. How so? The man beat Roman Reigns clean, the person you think will beat Brock, so Isn't it possible that with the right build and storytelling, it could be a classic David versus Goliath brawl? Also, you said you couldn't remember the pile driver ever legit injuring someone, but given how Steve Austin broke his neck, don't you think the banning of the move is fair? No, it's not. It's ridiculous. One pile driver, okay, or two pile drivers, if you count the other one that I mentioned, is not a reason to ban the pile driver. Owen fucked up, plain and simple. He had a momentary lapse in judgment, and he fell on his ass when he should have dropped to his knees. You don't ban the move because of that. On the Balor stuff, look, yeah, with the right build, maybe they could have a hell of a match, okay? I see your point. But Roman Reigns, okay, as big as he is, he ain't Brock Lesnar. We've actually seen Roman Reigns lose quite a few matches of late, okay? He looks a little less invincible than he did once upon a time. It's all about perception. He's not perceived as this unstoppable force like Brock Lesnar is. That's why I said it was laughable, and I still think it would be laughable. 2 years ago, I don't think that I would have said that. That's why I wanted to see Bryan and Lesnar. At least Bryan, you know, he had a lot of submission moves. He could, you know, use them on Brock, and you know, Balor doesn't really have that. That's why I just don't see it. This comes from Mark. Love the show. Question for you and other listeners who follow TV ratings. Why are they so important to you? Why harp on TV ratings and not merch sales or YouTube hits? WWE has diversified its revenue streams and content distribution channels tremendously over the past half decade. I haven't watched Raw or SmackDown on TV in a long time, but I do watch the edited versions on Hulu when I can, and I subscribe to their network. My nephew is in college, watches everything through YouTube or on-demand services like the WWE Network. In general, younger people trend away from TV. They tune in through Twitter, YouTube, and on-demand services. When I hear you and others go on about TV ratings, I understand it's important, but think about it from WWE's perspective. Would Disney worry about ratings for the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse? They have movies, merchandise, live events, major attractions, and all sorts of other properties bringing in revenue. I don't get why you focus so heavily on TV ratings. In WWE's business model, ratings aren't even a proxy for them. Their TV can tank, and they could still make record profits. So, why are TV numbers a big deal? Well, WWE has a market... I checked on this after I got your question. WWE has a market cap of $1.5 billion, and Disney has a market cap of $152 billion. So if the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse flops on TV, I think they'll be okay. But I do get your point. Okay, here's the thing. You're right and you're wrong. Okay, I harp on ratings when they go really low, or if they go really high, I'll mention it. It's not like I'm giving weekly ratings updates on my show. Okay, look, I've been comparing Raw and SmackDown ever since the brand split started, okay, in terms of like what was the better show. I don't think one time have I mentioned their TV ratings since the split. Okay, but I do sometimes mention them, and part of it I think is probably, you know, some of that Monday Night War mentality. Everybody got so wrapped up in the television ratings between Raw and Nitro that even when Nitro died, the ratings were still viewed as kind of the end-all be-all. And you're right. You're right about one thing. The ratings are no longer the end-all be-all. But you can't dismiss how important they still are. Okay, WWE got $100 million increase. I think it was about $100 million increase in their TV rights with their last deal when they made that deal with NBC Universal. That was 2 years ago, okay? And as great as that sounds, even Vince McMahon at the time talked about how disappointed they were with that number because he was out there for months before claiming it would be double that. We're going to get double that in rights fees. And they didn't. And now they're locked into that deal. I want to say, I believe it's through 2019. So unless there's an out clause or something in that contract, they're safe for another few years. It's not like if Raw does a 1.5 next week, they're going to be off the air. But the fact is, there has been a steady decline in their Raw ratings over the last several years. That is a fact. Now, if that trend were to continue, and we still don't know what the bottoming out point is for that show, okay, like how low can it go? We don't know, but it's gone pretty damn low a bunch of times this year. So long as WWE can keep USA Network at or near the top, of the weekly cable ratings. They're fine. I mean, that's all USA really cares about. SmackDown's up so far since the brand split, so they have to be happy about that. But let's say at some point that changes, okay, and SmackDown falls back into the doldrums that it was in before. That could have a very big effect on WWE if, let's say, USA decides to move SmackDown to a different night. They wouldn't be able to go live anymore. Tuesday is the only night, really, where it's feasible for SmackDown to be live. Just in terms of, you know, the production guys being on the road and all that, you can't really do that on any other night. WWE doesn't want that. And they don't want Raw to get low enough where USA becomes unhappy with how the show is doing. Now, all of a sudden, you've got USA Network executives. They're trying to exert influence on the creative direction of the show. Supposedly, they've done this before. And we heard that even with Destination America and TNA, that Destination America wanted Kurt Angle as the champion. I mean, when the network starts getting involved in the creative process, that's never a good sign. And that's not something WWE wants. If the numbers suddenly got low enough, you know, they may do it again. That's something I'm sure WWE does not want. Or even worse, right? If USA were to fall out of those top rankings every week because Raw and SmackDown suddenly weren't as strong, once that TV deal comes up for renewal in a couple of years, WWE could be negotiating from a position of weakness. And you never want to negotiate from a position of weakness. And you're right, you know, they're turning record profits. You're absolutely right. They're turning record profits, they're making money from their YouTube channel and all these different revenue streams that they didn't have 10 years ago. Or 5 years ago. But let's not forget the last time that WWE tried to get a new TV deal when they left Spike. They were negotiating to go back to USA. And what did Spike do? Spike knew they were gone, so they canceled Raw. They put a press release out or some kind of announcement saying they were canceling Monday Night Raw. So suddenly WWE, they didn't have any negotiating leverage. Nobody else wanted them. So they went back to USA for a lesser deal than the one that they had wanted. But none of the other networks that, you know, they thought were, well, surely they're going to want us. I mean, look, we have, you know, this weekly product. We have a new show every single week. We have no off season and we're so popular. None of the other networks wanted them. And that was a big wake up call for WWE. And I know the company makes more money now than it did then. But, you know, if something like that happened once, it could happen again. And that's why do you think Vince McMahon got so serious about the network? He said never again. Never again are we going to be in a position like that. God forbid if they ever were, at least now they have their own network. They could put Raw and SmackDown on there. But the question is, can you convert all of those Raw and SmackDown viewers to paying subscribers to your network? If USA canceled Raw, it's not like suddenly, you know, the WWE network is going to shoot up to 3 or 4 million subscribers. I mean, maybe over time, eventually, they can get it there. And if they can get 3 or 4 million subscribers to pay $9.99, then good for them. You're still not replacing that $200 million in TV revenue that you had before. You know, WWE may know, hey, you know, we're pulling in $2.5 million on TV, but we have all these YouTube subscribers and network subscribers. USA doesn't care about that. They want people to watch USA on Monday nights. And maybe some of those wrestling fans, if they're lucky, they'll tune into some of their other shows, like Suits and what, you know, whatever other shows they have. That's all they care about. If they ever lost that deal, I mean, that's a big blow to WWE if they ever lost that deal. You cannot minimize the importance of that TV contract, of that TV rights money. And I'm sure come 2019, they're going to want double or triple that. Remember, they thought they would be getting NASCAR money. NASCAR's getting something like $800 million a year with its new TV deal. And yet, and here's the funny thing about that. And yet, I remember reading that, I think it was an Ad Week maybe, that NASCAR's ratings were on the decline, and this was 2 years ago, NASCAR's ratings were on the decline when they made that deal. They may have been down by percentage more than WWE's ratings have been down. And yet, they got a much bigger TV contract. But the thing is, NASCAR is a sport. You know, WWE didn't start selling itself as like a sports entity until they wanted that big sports TV rights contract, right? Because they wouldn't call themselves a sport before that. Oh, no. We're entertainment. Only when it suits them, all of a sudden, do they become a sport. Like when they used to put those Did You Know facts on TV every week about how we were ranked number one in the sports category of new DVDs. Well, yeah, of course, they were number one in sports, so now they're going to tout how we're number one in sports. So they wanted a sports contract. They wanted the TV rights money that the other sports organizations were getting, but they're not a sport, right? That's the whole thing. NASCAR is a sport. WWE is not. We can call it a sport. I can call it a sport. You can call it a sport, but that doesn't make it a sport. ESPN can cover it like a sport, but it's not considered a sport. So NASCAR can shit the bed in the ratings and still get a fat new TV deal because sports programming is so, you know, desirable. And NASCAR has no problem getting sponsors. WWE has always had a problem getting like major big time sponsors to advertise during their shows. TNA had that issue. Ring of Honor had that issue. It's not just the WWE thing. And I think USA controls all of that now. That was one of the kind of pieces of leverage that WWE lost when they made that deal. And I think USA now is the one who kind of handles all that. I think they're the ones selling the ad time during the WWE show. I mean, I could be wrong. And I'm sure it's very difficult to get car companies and other big brands to advertise during their shows. And still to this day, forget the Attitude Era and all that. Still in 2016, it's hard for them to get sponsors like that. Even with all the money they make, it's still a challenge because there's this perception of them. So NASCAR can go down, but they're not going to have a problem finding somebody to pay them a boatload of money, you know, whenever that contract ends. I mean, it could be a 10-year contract. I don't know how long it's for. WWE does not have that advantage. They have to make sure that people are still watching their product. They can't just rest and say, well, you know, who cares if the ratings go down? We're still going to get a lot of money. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. If their shows fall off a cliff, they're in trouble. Right now, they're okay. They're not in jeopardy of getting booted off the air or anything like that. And in fact, I think when 2019 rolls around, I think they'll probably do just fine, and they'll probably bring in at least as much as they're making now, maybe more. They'll be okay. But don't dismiss the TV ratings just because they have 12 million YouTube subscribers and they have their own network. 12 million YouTube subscribers, by the way, they can only convert 1.5 million paying customers to their network. Imagine if they got half those YouTube subscribers to subscribe to their network and actually pay for it. I agree. I mean, they should diversify the way they deliver their content, but they still have to keep those TV ratings strong. They still have to keep USA happy. If their TV tanks, I'm using your word now, okay? If their TV tanks, that's not a good thing. If things ever go south on the TV front, it may not kill the company because they're so freaking big now, but there could be cutbacks, people can lose their jobs. You know, it makes them a weaker company. Marieke from the Netherlands. After listening to Nakamura's promo on NXT this week, I can't help but think he needs a manager to survive on the main roster. Same goes for Asuka and Hideo Itami. I was thinking Paul Heyman would be a perfect fit for Nakamura, Asuka or both. I also think that with the influx of Japanese and Asian talent, a Shield-like Asian stable could be awesome as well, again with Heyman or someone else as a manager. How would you feel about Paul Heyman managing the King and Queen of Strong Style? Or do you know a better manager for them? And would you like the idea of an Asian stable? You know what? When I got your question, it's funny. I had just read that Truth Martini has been cut from Ring of Honor, or his deal wasn't renewed, whatever it was. They're not bringing him back. They didn't have anything for him. And I was really sad to hear that because I like Truth Martini. I thought he was a really good manager. He's a good talker. I think that WWE ought to snatch him up. I know they don't, you know, they have a few managers now, but it's not like they really focus on them as much as they used to. But I think that he would be a positive addition for their roster. Now, I don't know that Truth Martini would be a good fit for Nakamura or for Asuka. At least not Nakamura as a babyface. It would really make no sense. But I could see, you know, Truth Martini being a good fit for a team like the Revival when they get called up. Not that they can't talk, but just like as part of their act, I think that could work. Maybe a Cesaro could benefit from having somebody like him in his corner. So when I saw your question, I thought of what I had just read about Truth Martini, and I just think that WWE should pick him up. You know, they brought Paul Ellering back, and he's doing his thing with the Authors of Pain in NXT. And Ellering doesn't say a damn word. He just kind of shows up and he nods his head and he leaves. That's all he does. I think somebody like Truth Martini, whether it's on the main roster or NXT, could probably add a lot and could probably help some people out. Paul Heyman and Nakamura, you know, people still talk about, I wish Heyman would, you know, who's going to be the next Heyman guy or Heyman girl. If it hasn't happened by now, it's not happening. It's very obvious that, you know, they see Heyman as an important piece of the package with Brock Lesnar. Heyman and Brock, I mean, that's, you know, they're a package deal there. And if they wanted to create a stable of Heyman guys, they would have done it by now. I mean, how long has he been back for, right? And Heyman does his own thing. He only works part-time, really, for WWE. He's got his own company. And I don't know that he wants to come back to TV full-time and manage an entire stable of people. So my whole thing is, if it hasn't happened by now, it's probably not going to happen. They put Cesaro with him, and everybody had so much hope. Wow, this is going to be so cool. And then look what happened. So even if they do start putting people with Paul Heyman, unless they get behind them, is it really going to matter? It didn't really do Cesaro a whole lot of good. I don't know how much of that you can lay on Heyman, as much as they just didn't give, you know, they didn't make it much of a priority. So I'm not even sure that would be such a good idea. And this idea of an Asian stable, I'm not really a fan of that either, just because I think Asian stable, I think of what they did with Kai and Tai. You know, I mean, is that, it's like, I remember that period in 97. And 97 is one of my favorite years in WWF, just because there were so many things happening that year. And it was really, I traced the birth of Attitude back to the end of 96, but that whole year was the birth of Attitude. There were a lot of things in 97 to really like, but one of the things I absolutely hated was later in the year, they did this gang warfare stuff, especially heading into the Survivor Series. And there was like a gang. There were multiple gangs in WWE. You had like the white skinheads, and you had the Los Boricuas were the Hispanic guys, and you had, I don't think they had an Asian faction. They had the Nation, right? Okay, so you have here's the African Americans, here's the Hispanics, and here's the the white bikers, and oh my God, it was so boring. Ugh. I mean, there were periods of the Nation that were fun, but just the whole gang warfare thing and less, you know, oh God, it was so fucking boring. It's almost like, let's take all the Asian people on the roster and put them in a group. Like, I don't know. To me, it just seems stupid. I don't think you need to do that. I don't think that's necessary. It could be cool. I'm not saying that, you know, if you don't play your cards right, that it can't work. I don't see it working in WWE. I just don't see it working. Billy in Des Moines. I've always thought it was strange how Bret Hart won his first WWF title without much fanfare at a house show. Who knows the real reasons why Vince did what he did, but it's kind of perplexing that Bret didn't get the same build-up that guys like Shawn Michaels and Steve Austin got leading up to their first title reign. My question is, if Vince could have done the slow build for Bret with him eventually winning the title at WrestleMania 9, who of these three opponents would you have liked to see him go up against? Randy Savage, with him endorsing Bret in the end as the future of the company. Ric Flair, at this point, Flair would have had the title for 8 months and people would have been clamoring to see Bret get his shot. Or Yokozuna, with Bret taking down the unbeatable giant against all odds. Of the three, it should have been Flair. Savage would have been a good one too, but I just think it would be better for Bret to have, you know, I don't know. I think if you're trying to create the next big hero and trying to create this, like, clamoring to see somebody beat Flair for the championship, you go with the heel. And that's what Flair was. And it would have been a really good match. I know Flair, is it Flair or Bret? I think Flair maybe in his book said that he thought the match they had in Saskatoon was shit. Probably because Flair was hurt. I think he had wrestled the Ultimate Warrior and the Warrior hurt him and his equilibrium, something with his eardrum, he was all fucked up, and so maybe that's why he thought the match was no good. I've watched that match multiple times. I thought it was a really good match. And I think if you put those two guys in the main event at a WrestleMania, you're going to have a fucking awesome match. Especially with Bret putting him in the sharpshooter and the place going nuts when Flair submits. I mean, the reason he left WWE in the first place was because Vince was very obviously phasing him out of the main event picture. And he had a gentleman's agreement with Vince that if that ever happened, if he was ever being booted out of the main event, he would allow Flair to leave and go back to WCW. Which sounds unbelievable that Vince would make that deal, but that's what he did. He let Flair go back to WCW. Now, there was some kind of a clause or a non-compete or something where Flair couldn't wrestle right away, so that's why Flair was doing talk show segments for a while. But Vince was a man of his word, and he let Flair go back to WCW. So if you keep the championship on Flair at the end of 92 and you don't take it off of him, you keep him around until WrestleMania. And then if you want, you can phase him down and let him go. But I think of the three, that's the match that I would have done. I think that's the match that would have probably done the best business. David has a great buy or sell on the better 10-man tag team match. The Hart Foundation against Steve Austin, Ken Shamrock, Goldust, and LOD at Canadian Stampede in 97. Or DX and the Radicals against The Rock, Cactus Jack, Too Cool, and Rikishi on Raw in 2000, which I'm sure he's including here because he knows it's one of my favorite matches. So, well played, David. First of all, if you've never seen that match on Raw from 2000, go on the network right now and watch it. It is a shit ton of fun. You don't get crowds like that much anymore. And almost everybody in that match, pretty much, if not everybody in that match, was super over. I mean, Rikishi and Too Cool were over, Cactus was over, Rock was over. But I have to buy on the Canadian Stampede match. The building literally shook for parts of that match. You've got the Hart Foundation in Canada in 97. That was a lot of fun. The one part of the match that really sticks out in my mind still is right at the beginning. Brett's in the corner with Austin. He's just stomping a mud hole in Austin. And the hard camera literally shakes. Like, this place is rocking. And like I said, watching the Hart Foundation in Canada was just, it was so great. It didn't matter what those guys did, no matter how dastardly they were. Pillman could have shot Austin dead in the street and they still would have cheered him for it. That was a special match. It's depressing somewhat to look back on when you consider how many of them are gone now, but that's still got to be their, it's got to be one of their greatest pay-per-view matches of all time, of any pay-per-view. I'm not just talking just tag matches or in-your-house shows, any pay-per-view they've ever done. That whole Canadian Stampede show is one of the best shows they've ever put on. And a big part of it was that 10-man tag. Sad tweet this week goes to, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, although in a way I don't really give a shit, but it's Ayman El Hassan with ESPN, at Ayman ESPN. After Kevin Owens won the Universal title, he had put some pictures online, or his wife did, I think, of his son Owen at home celebrating with the title, and he was so happy that his father had won the championship. The kid's like 8 years old. And there was a tweet that, it might have been ESPN or some sports site, tweeted out a link to a story about it. It said, 8-year-old son of WWE's Kevin Owens was so overwhelmed about his dad winning the title belt. And this guy from ESPN, who I honestly have never heard of before, I don't know who he is. I still don't know who he is. I know he works for ESPN. That's all I know. He tweeted, until someone told him it was scripted. Now, not the first person to make some stupid remark about wrestling being scripted. Who gives a shit, right? But it upset a lot of people because basically what he was doing, you know, the story was about his son. It wasn't about Kevin Owens winning some fake wrestling title. It was about the guy's son. His son was happy that his dad won the championship. And this clown had to go and make a comment about it that he thought was funny. And of course it wasn't. And even the coach who works for ESPN called him out on it. People got very upset. Some people got a little too upset. I just thought because of the kid being involved, it was just a stupid thing for him to say. And so a few days went by, and all of a sudden, Mr. El Hassan tweeted this out. He said, I tweeted a joke about wrestling earlier this week, and it was in poor taste. I sincerely apologize to Kevin Owens and his family. I have no doubt that ESPN told him to put up the apology. Not a doubt in my mind. But nonetheless, he apologized. I think we can all move on. People got really angry about this. Like I said, I didn't get angry. I just thought, okay, there's your sad tweet for the week. Like, this kid's happy his dad won the belt, and you got to take a shot at him, and I just thought it was low class. He posted an apology. I don't know how sincere it is, but he apologized. We can all move on. As far as I'm concerned, this is a non-story now. So, before we wrap up, we, as I mentioned earlier, are going to be doing a countdown over the next 9 weeks leading up to our 9-year anniversary podcast on November 6th of the nine best or my nine favorite wrestling interviews / promos in WWE history. We are keeping this to a WWE only list because it was impossible for me to narrow my original list down to only 9. So the first thing I did was I took out all the non-WWE ones, and I still had a surplus of like 4, so I had to cut it down from there. But we got it down to 9, and we're going to start with number 9 this week. One of my favorite all-time promos is from a guy who, in my opinion, is not even probably, he is the best villain. He is easily the best heel in WWE history, one of the best heels in wrestling history. And that is Mr. McMahon. We've seen a lot of great Vince McMahon promos over the years. A lot of bad, very repetitive Vince McMahon promos. But there's been a lot of great ones in there. Vince was certainly at his best in that period from like 98 to 2000, 2001. We got a lot of good stuff in there from him. And I can tell you probably my favorite. That's why it's on this list. My favorite Vince McMahon promo is one that I know some of you are going to remember. It was from an episode of SmackDown. On May 11th of 2000, and the entire McMahon-Helmsley faction was in the ring. So Pat Patterson had something to say. He talked about wearing a pair of underwear with skid marks when he gave Rikishi a stink face. Hope nobody was eating while you were listening to this podcast. Shane McMahon had something to say about Big Show. This is when Shane was doing his whole which way did he go? Which way did Shane go? When he was feuding with the Big Show. Triple H talked. And then finally, Vince McMahon spoke. And to just set some of the backstory here, the McMahon-Helmsley faction was not very fair to a lot of people on the roster. Chris Jericho was the Intercontinental Champion at the time, and I guess on the Monday prior to this show, on the Raw previous to this episode of SmackDown, they had put Chris Jericho in 3 separate matches on the show, all of which were for his Intercontinental title. And Jericho won 2 of them, and then in the last one, he finally lost to Chris Benoit. So essentially, they had screwed Jericho out of the Intercontinental Championship. And they had just announced an Iron Man match was going to be taking place at the next pay-per-view between Rock and Triple H. So Vince took the microphone, and he, of course, was serenaded by Chance of Asshole, as he was many times back then. And he was on television. He was a giant asshole, which is why he worked so well. And he talked about the fact, look, you know, I get it. I get that a lot of you feel like Chris Jericho is treated unfairly, and we made him wrestle 3 different times on one show and defend his title, but you know what? That's just too damn bad. Because sometimes things aren't fair. And then he went into different examples of things that aren't fair. And he talked about how, you know, you people are the kind of people, you'll wait in line and you'll wait forever. You're all lined up, you're waiting for your turn. And, you know, you'll see someone like me very aggressively cut in front of the line and you'll say, wait a minute, that's not fair. And then he talks about the parking lot. You'll be in the parking lot, there you are, you're waiting for a parking space, and there it is, all of a sudden a spot opens up, and you're driving your car, and up, somebody zips in and cuts you off and takes your spot, and you say, well, wait a minute, that's my parking space, that's not fair. And just the way he said it, it was so fucking funny. And I have to say, he could be annoying at times, but you had Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler on commentary, and Lawler was just cackling like a hyena throughout this whole thing. And it actually added to it. I thought it actually made this funnier whenever Lawler would laugh and would chime in here. But the parking lot thing is what got me. That to me was the funniest part of this whole promo. So again, he talks about how that's not fair, and you know, then of course he gets into the example of sometimes you'll look in the full length mirror. And by the way, his pronunciation of the word mirror here is fantastic. You've got to find this promo and listen to it for yourself. And he says, you'll look in the mirror, and you'll look at yourselves, and if you're a woman, you'll say, oh, look at the cellulite on my hips, and look at my buttocks, that's not fair. And you men look in the mirror, and you say, well, that can't be me with the pot belly and the small genitalia. And that's where Lawler said, oh, he really is talking about you, Michael. And he goes on, and he just talks about the fact that, you know, let's talk about the money. Let's talk about the money. And he says, you people, you scrimp and you save and you work yourselves half to death. And still, you can't afford what you want. That's not fair. It's not fair that some people are rich and some people are not rich. That's not fair. And he says, some people are just born with inferior DNA. And you say, well, that's not fair. I was born with inferior DNA. But you feel sorry for yourselves and you wallow in your self-pity. And at another point in the promo, he actually tells each person in the crowd, look at the person next to you. Look how ugly they are. And it was just, it was, I hate to use this word because Cole uses it all the time, but it really was like that vintage Mr. McMahon evil prick boss promo. I don't know what it was about this one in particular, but this is the one that stands out to me the most. And it stands out to me for the final line of the promo. Because he gives all these examples, and he's got the crowd booing him. He's making everybody just feel like total shit. And the entire McMahon-Helmsley group is behind him. They're smiling, and they're laughing, and they're nodding their heads, and they're agreeing with everything that he has to say. And finally, he gets to the end of the promo, and he says, and some of you, a select few, you might as well go ahead and admit, you might as well own up to the philosophy, for some of you, which is that life sucks, and then you die. And that was the money line, and I just thought, that to me is the all-time best Vince McMahon promo. To this day, 16 years, 16 and a half years later, whatever it's been, that is still the Vince McMahon promo above all else that stands out to me in my mind, and to me is one of the greatest promos that I've ever heard in that company. So it's the May 11th, 2000 episode of SmackDown. You don't even have to look for the full show. It might be on the network, actually. It should be on the network. But you can find it on YouTube. Just type in, it's the infamous, or the famous, I should say, Vince McMahon Life Sucks promo. It should come right up. And I just thought the delivery of it, it kind of makes me sad now when I see Vince. You know, he's still Vince, but like he's not the Vince of old. This is the Vince McMahon that I remember. And to me, this is an all-time great promo. So I have that one at number 9 on my list of the greatest WWE promos of all time. Next week, we will reveal number 8. And again, we'll do one of these each week. We might even play some audio from some of them. I don't want to play the whole thing. I want you guys to go find it and watch it and listen to it for you. And some of these promos, as we go along here, they're very long. So I don't want to play some and not others. This one's actually relatively short. I think it's only about 5 minutes or so. But there are some promos on this list that go on for a lot longer than that. Some really good ones, too. I'm looking forward to getting into these. So leave your thoughts and check that promo out. If you do find it on YouTube, you can tell them I sent you. And if you have questions for the mailbag, you can email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please, again, include your name and where you are from. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. I'm getting close to 19,000 followers on there. We have the poll up every week after Raw, thumbs up, thumbs down. We even do it for SmackDown sometimes when I remember to. See, the thing with SmackDown is I don't always watch it. In fact, a lot of times I don't watch SmackDown live. And so if I'm not watching it live, I don't always remember to put the promo up right away at 10 o'clock. But we do have thumbs up, thumbs down. You can vote there. Check out all of the past episodes in our archives on thesolemonster.com. You can make a PayPal donation there if you'd like to. You can check out our shows on iTunes and Stitcher, Audio Boom, TuneIn Radio, Google Play Music. We're pretty much all over the place. And we are a 5-star rated podcast on iTunes. You can leave some love for us there. Show some love to TV Tracks. We've gotten a lot of fans through his channel. He puts our clips up every week as well. And one last thank you again for all the love on the Rolling Stone thing. It was really cool. I mean, when I found out about it from you guys, to be honest with you. I was at work. I was in the middle of something, and I started getting tweets from people, and I saw there was a whole thread. People beat me to it on our Facebook page about, you know, congratulations. And I'm like, for what? I didn't know what was going on. And then I finally found out, and I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. I didn't get a heads up on it or anything. It just got published, and there it was. So congrats to everybody on the list, including Don Tony and Kevin Castle. It's very well deserved. It's a very cool thing to see when you do get acknowledged in some way. It's a cool feeling. So enjoy the holiday, those of you who do have the day off, which I hope is pretty much most of you who live in this country. And we will be back with a brand new podcast and another great promo in our countdown next weekend. That'll be episode 460. So until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and we will see you right back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solid Monster sounds off.
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Monster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solid Monster sounds off. Available at thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solid Monster sound off.